it, if not all of it. I'm sorry if you're going to get bored
during these lectures. And under the general title of algebra, I'm going to be mentioning things that have to do with linear algebra. I'm going to do some group theory, some abstract algebra stuff. And hopefully at the last lecture, we're going to do one lecture just on the Lorentz group, which will be useful for your relativity course. So while you each get one of these notes, you can pass them around, I'm just going to write a brief outline, very rough, of what we're going to do. So today we're going to review some linear algebra. Tomorrow we'll do group theory. On Thursday, we're going to go over the definition of an algebra and study some examples of algebras. And as I said, next week, we're going to talk about the Lorentz group. In more detail. So hopefully I will cover most of what you will need for your relativity and quantum mechanics courses. Hopefully QFT1 will also not require much more. And maybe sometime in between QFT1 and QFT2, you'll have some more lectures on Lie groups and Lie algebras, which we won't have time to cover in this review. Okay, so what I pass around, and I guess that everyone has a copy by now, okay, are just some definitions from linear algebra. If you want to have a look through them now, and I'm guessing that more or less everything will be known. This is not complete. It's just some definitions, but it's a good start, let's say. So if you want to look through the definition of a vector space, over the set of complex numbers, and we denote here, I'm going to use the ket notation for vectors. It doesn't really matter, but since we want to make a connection with quantum mechanics, let's use this. And we're going to use, say, Greek letters for complex numbers. These are just numbers. And then for now, let's also look at the definition of a scalar product. And again, let me just write the notation here. So for now, let's denote a scalar product of two vectors by some brackets with the two vectors inside. And this is a number. A basis for our vector space is a set of vectors that I'm going to denote for now by EI. So I here is an index that runs from 1 up to the dimensionality of my vector space. And let's start also using Dirac's notation. for the scalar product. So let's also write this as a bracket. I'm assuming that you have seen those things before. If not, by the way, if there's any chance you haven't seen them, and you're embarrassed to raise your hand now and say, I don't know what you're talking about, you can always come and talk to me later. Okay, so where have you seen those things in your physics so far? This notation, where does it appear usually? Quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics is probably the major reason of why we are learning and reviewing right now linear algebra. So in quantum mechanics, we describe a physical system by a wave function. Excuse my handwriting. And this wave function belongs to a vector space called the Hilbert space. Now, any physical observable should be described by an operator. And actually, in quantum mechanics, we know that this has to be a Hermitian operator. So we are going to review later what the definition of the adjoint is, but I'm sure you already know that this means that the adjoint of the operator has to be the same as the operator itself. And physical information is encoded in probabilities. For example, the probability of our system changing from a state psi to some different state phi is given by this. So this is why we want to do linear algebra, essentially. And let's do a more concrete example. Let's study a particle in a well. Or a one-dimensional box, if you want. Let's say our box has length L. And if this direction is x, then we know that the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian in this problem. Can be written like this. Where n can be 0, 1, 2, and so on. These are all the different energy levels. What is the Hilbert space in this problem? Our vector space. A It is the space of all physical states in here, which have to be described. So how should I write this? So a physical state here can be any function defined for x between 0 and L. This can be a complex valued function. And we also know that it has to vanish at 0 and L. And it has to be square integrable so that probabilities make sense. OK, so now let's go back to these basic definitions. Why is the Hilbert space a vector space? So if we go to the amazing notes that I gave you, vector addition is satisfied here. If we add two of these functions, we still remain inside the Hilbert space. Scalar multiplication, same thing. If we multiply any of these functions with a complex number, the result is, again, a vector in this vector space. Does anyone want me to go over the rest of the properties in the definition? Or is this clear? I'm not sure how to interpret this. Let's say that it is clear that this is a vector space so that you don't get too bored. Now, the eigenstates of our Hamiltonian form a basis in this vector space. So let me add these things. This satisfies the properties in the definition of a vector space. And the set of these wave functions are actually a basis. For the Hilbert space, let's see why. OK, so again, if you look at the definition of a basis, you see that it is a maximal set of linearly independent vectors. So again, let's just do one thing. Let's quickly see why these vectors are linearly independent. So let's assume that we can use a different letter, I, or N is fine. Let's assume that we can find numbers in C, A, N, such that a linear combination of our vectors is equal to 0. Now we can always multiply this equation by another sign. And then we can also integrate this over x. Let me rewrite this. And I also have a normalizing factor here. Now, if you remember what this integral is, can anyone tell me what this integral is? Great. So this is zero if m and n are different. And if they are equal, you have a constant, in which case it's we get a factor of L over 2. So I can write this as L over 2 times a Kronecker delta.
How can we need to do the calculation to show that if you know that the eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian form on all the normal basis?
Say it again, sorry.
How can you need to do the calculation to show that if you know that the eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian form on all the normal basis?
You're right, but now, okay, so maybe I should have said why I'm doing all this. I'm just trying to go through the definitions through some examples. So we know, indeed, if you know that the Hamiltonian is a Hermitian operator, then you already know that its eigenvectors form an orthonormal basis. But now let's say that we don't know that or we don't believe that. Let's just see why this is a basis, because it does indeed satisfy the definition for a basis. Yeah? Otherwise, what you're saying is absolutely correct. So overall here, I do get this thing. And then, of course, the Kronecker delta just gives me an AM here. So this is and if I had kept the right-hand side of my equation here, I would have seen that this is equal to zero. So this indeed proves that signs defined over an interval, a finite interval, or you can also show it for an infinite interval, are linearly independent. And since we want our function to also have, to also vanish at 0 and L, we know that every complex function can be actually expanded in signs. So let me write this down. We showed that this set of vectors are linearly independent. And we also know that any function can be expanded in terms of these functions. So this is indeed a basis for my Hilbert space. Now let's define a scalar product on this vector space. And this is how we usually define a scalar product in quantum mechanics. Now again, if we look at the definition of a scalar product, let's just quickly check that this is indeed well defined. So what we want is that it is conjugate symmetric, so that if I write the scalar product between psi and phi instead of phi and psi, I get indeed the conjugate of this scalar product. I also want linearity in this argument, which is also easy to prove. Let me write phi times a psi plus b. Then I'm going to have a psi plus b chi, and we know that integration is linear, so this is indeed a times phi psi plus b times phi chi. This is also fine. And then finally, we do know that any scalar product of a vector with itself does give us something that is greater than zero, unless this function is zero everywhere. In which case this is equal to zero. So all I've done now is that I've checked that this definition is okay for a scalar product. This is a well-defined scalar product. And it is easy to check, but I think you can do this on your own, that my basis is also orthonormal, which, as Daniel said, is also expected since we build our basis from the eigenstates of a Hermitian operator, our Hamiltonian. Now, before I move on, let me give you one more thing. So if you want to take these around, these are some very, very simple exercises, just so that you don't fall asleep during the lecture. Okay. So I'm going to ask you to We can hear you. So I'm going to ask you during the lecture to just take a couple of minutes to do those exercises. And then in the end, I'm going to collect them. You can or cannot. It's up to you. Write your name on them. I just want to see that we're all at the same level, same pace. Just checking. You don't have to write a name if you don't want to. So if you want to just take a couple of minutes and do the first exercise, which says that if we know from the definition of the scalar product that it is linear in its second. AV people, we can hear you. So please take a couple of minutes to prove that the scalar product is antilinear in its first argument. They will realize at some point. Tell me. Yes. So, why do I write both? Okay. So let me talk about the dual space and the Dirac notation, and maybe it will become. It's equivalent. We can write both.
Just tell them to mute their microphone.
Can they hear us?
Sorry.
I said just tell them to mute their microphone.
They can hear you.
Sorry?
Whom should I prevent?
Like in the mirror.
Oh, do you think it's from there? I don't think it's from there. This is someone thinking about physics.
I thought it was
from somewhere inside the building. Okay, I'm sorry, AV people. Can you hear me? There is a problem here.
I'll be right there.
Awesome.
Okay, let me actually go through the definition of, we can hear other people talking through our speakers.
Including you.
Is it the people from the video conferencing up in the back?
We heard an "I'll be right there" right after she
That was me.
Yeah, the problem is that we hear. I think this is some physicists from within perimeter talking.
Let me look into it.
Sorry about this.
Thank you. Talk about ray optics features in exosolar planet.
Also lecture about that. So this is awesome. You get a lecture and a seminar at the same time.
Hi.
So we have been using Dirac's notation, but now I want to explain why this makes sense to use and actually define the co-vectors for us are vectors as vectors of a different vector space, which we call the dual space. So the dual space is the space of all maps that you can define. Let's call them rho. From my original vector space to C. So the scalar product is one such map, right? Because it takes me from two vectors in my vector space into C. But I actually want a map that takes me from one vector to
and
C.
And can do is
so let me define this map.
Any
vector X in my vector space.
Yes, we can plan it, then our horizon size in our
is taken to the scalar product between the vector x and another vector y, which is a constant vector. So this is a map from V to C.
By the rho.
And I am going to denote this map as actually bra of y. So I can write that this map acting on the vector x gives me the scalar product between y and x for every vector x in my vector space. So what we call the bra, or more formally a covector, is a vector in this dual space. And it is not hard to check that this dual space is also a vector space. In other words, it does satisfy the definition of the vector space that I have given you. This vector space also has a basis, which we call the dual basis. And which I'm going to denote like this. Let me write this. clearer way. These are cofactors labeled by an index I, which I choose to write on the top. This is an upper index. You will see why this choice actually makes sense. And I am defining all these vectors to be such that their scalar product with the vectors in my basis. I'm sorry, these are maps. So this map acting on a vector in the basis of my original vector space just gives me a Kronecker delta. Does this make sense? We'll see later on that. No, let me not say this yet. Let's stay here. This means this map acting on the vector Ej. And since I'm using Dirac notation, this actually corresponds there must be a vector EI with, again, I'm keeping the index I here upper so that I don't confuse it with my original basis. There must be such a vector in my vector space so that this map is equal to the scalar product between the two. I'm going to come back to this notation in about 10 minutes from now. But in the meantime, I want first to remind you of the definition of the adjoint operator. This relation defines what the adjoint of the operator A is. Now, the adjoint is a map from the vector space to the vector space in the same way that here I am assuming that A is a map from V to V. In the same way, the adjoint also acts on V. And if I don't want to mess up my notation here. So if I write that Z is equal to AX, then one exercise that you might have done, if not, we will do in the tutorial today, is that the covector dual to this vector is given by the covector of the vector X times the adjoint of the operator A. And this is, again, an element of the dual space. Because the adjoint operator itself is an element of the dual space,
the covector is an element of the dual space, and if we combine the two, we still get an element of the dual space. Okay, so why don't you take maybe 5 minutes to do the exercises that have to do with the adjoint operator? Maybe not the last one yet. Not the one that has to do with the matrix representation. So one of the things I want to get to know is matrix representation, but since I needed to talk about the adjoint operator in the meantime, let's also quickly go through the definitions of Hermitian and unitary operators. Hermitian operators are self-adjoint. And some of the things we know about Hermitian operators is that their eigenvalues are always real.
the eigenvectors form orthonormal bases. You will do those things in the tutorial again today. And in physics, physical observables are always described by Hermitian operators. Unitary operators, let's denote them by U, are defined such to be such that the product of the operator with its adjoint is equal to U dagger U, and it is equal to the unit operator. In physics, unitary operators describe the evolution in quantum mechanics of our states. If I start from a state U and, sorry, from a state psi, and I evolve it with an operator U, and I call this new state psi prime, then psi prime is actually psi U dagger U. Psi, which is equal to the original scalar product. And thus we see that probabilities are preserved. So if initially I had some probability being in this state, and I evolve my state unitarily, then the probability stays the same. And the total probability will always be 1. Having said that, let's go back to matrix representation. So what I'm trying to do is represent vectors and operators in my vector space with matrices. And my representation has to preserve the action of the operators on my vectors. So again, let me just remind you that I denote by EI with I being a lower index, the basis for my vector space. And for now, let's assume that this is a finite dimensional vector space. Let's call the dimension n. Then I can expand any vector in these spaces. And here, I denote the coefficients in these expansions by psi I, with I being an upper index. And then I write those coefficients as a column vector, which compactly I can also sometimes write as psi I. So I can think of vectors in my vector space as column vectors in the matrix representation. And this is, of course, in the basis Yeah, if I change to another basis, these coefficients will also change. This is usually called a contravariant vector. And because these are words that you will hear a lot during this year, let me just say that the raised index here, I, is indicative of the fact that this is a contravariant vector. So whenever you see an object with one upper index, or let me say 99% of the time, this would be a contravariant vector.
What makes the vector contravariant?
So let's say that for now we just call this thing a contravariant vector, but the definition that we will probably see next week is that it transforms, so any other vector will be also called contravariant. If under a change of basis, it transforms in the same way as this vector. But for now, let's just use this as a name for this kind of vectors. In the same way, we are going to represent covectors by row vectors instead of column vectors, and we will call those things covariant vectors. So up there, I have defined a basis for the dual space. This means that if brass I is a covector, a vector in V star, then I can expand in this basis. So to distinguish between the two, let me call those things psi bar i's. Because so far I haven't told you what the relation between this psi I and that psi I is. This is what I want to do now. So if I assume that this is actually the covector dual to that vector psi, then I can take this relation, and from that write that this has to be this again just follows from this property of the adjoint operator, which you will show in your tutorials. So here, so this covector is just dual to the vector EI in the original basis. And so far, we don't know what its relation is with that covector. I want to do one more thing. I want to define something that I call the metric. I'm going to denote it by Gij. And this is the scalar product between two vectors in my vector space V. I actually want to use this definition and this notation, assuming that this thing is symmetric and it is real. If it is symmetric, it is also real. So that Gij is equal to Gji. I want to work with vector spaces like that.
So the bra with the upper I index, this for one? Now that's just the random basis element, or as a
it is an element of the dual basis, which is defined like that over there. So this is a map that takes me, that takes any vector to a number, and it is defined to be such that when it acts to the vectors in my basis, it gives me a delta function. It is, it's time to use this thing. It is defined like that. Everything will make sense very soon.
But I have a question. When you have the bra with the lower index, it's also an element of the dual.
Yes.
So it's formed by the elements of the basis. So I don't understand. Both are dual elements.
Both are dual elements, but they are not the same.
Okay.
Because this is the element dual to the element in the basis.
Okay, I understand.
But the elements in the dual basis, sorry, the order of the words is important here, are defined like that.
So you're telling, yes, the element, the basis of the dual space are those.
Is defined like that.
And the dual of the element of B are those.
Are those, yes.
And how do you get from the first line to the second line?
These are independent. These two you mean, right? Okay, so in this line I have just written that any covector it should be possible to expand it in these spaces. And maybe I actually rushed in writing this expression. That's why I then decided to put a bar on this. And by bar here, I just mean that it is something different from psi I. Maybe let me write. But let's keep it like that for now. It's something different. And now this line follows from this line follows from that line. This line is just a decomposition in these spaces. So if we define a metric like this, we can also define the inverse of this matrix to be the inverse metric. I'm going to read out loud what I'm writing here so that you don't get the indices wrong. So this is the inverse matrix. I denote it as a matrix G with two upper indices. And here I have written that the matrix product between the metric and the inverse metric should just give me a Kronecker delta. So Gij times Gjk with sum over J gives us a delta Ik. This is again a definition. It's just an inverse matrix, nothing more than that. And if I want to, if you want the Kronecker delta in matrix components, it's just a unit matrix. I'm going to continue with more notation definitions. So again, it is my choice to define that I raise and lower indices with this metric or its inverse. In other words, if I take any vector, say psi I, with an upper index, then I define psi with a lower index. As G I J psi J with a summation here over J. And this is equivalent to say that I can raise indices using my inverse metric. So this is Gij psi j summing over j. So I am only left with an index I here. Now, let me try to apply this definition to the basis vectors as well and see if it is consistent. So I'm going to write that EI with an upper index is the sum over J of GIJ. I'm going to check now that this is consistent with this being the dual basis. I might be writing something here that is completely rubbish, but I'll show that it's not. I'll do it now. Let's take the scalar product between, the action of this covector on another basis element, Ej. Let's substitute this. I'm going to use k here as the index that is being summed over. So I substituted here the sum over gik ek for ei.
I know that this is my metric, a scalar product. This is how I have defined my metric. So this sum is, again, only the matrix product between the metric and its inverse. So this should give me another Kronecker delta. So now, using this metric, I have made a connection between the covector dual to the basis elements of V and the vectors in the dual basis that is actually consistent. Using this, let me see what the components that I denoted as psi bar are. I am running out of time. So I'm going to start again from this relation. I can even put a star on it. And I am going to raise and lower indices using my metrics. So I'm going to have various sums here over indices. So this is the first change I'm making. I am raising the index inside the dual vector, the covector, excuse me, EI. And next, I am lowering the index of psi. So I have added two summations here, J and K. J lowers or raises this index, and K lowers this index. However, I can choose to perform the summation over the index I first. So again, I will have inverse metric multiplying metric, which will give me another Kronecker delta. So if I do the summation over I will get delta j k e j I k star. And now we can use that Kronecker delta to do one more summation. Let's say we do the sum over k. So what I actually see is that the thing that I denote as psi bar has to be the complex conjugate of psi, where I have lowered the index from my original psi I using my metric. And I can represent the covector. This is our usual notation, with a row.
And this is called a covariant vector. In the same way, we can represent operators, linear operators, in our vector space by matrices. And again, the representation is valid only in a specific basis. How do we do that? We study the action of a linear operator EI on, sorry, A, on one element of the basis EI. Whatever the outcome is, I should be able to expand it again in the same basis, assuming that A, for simplicity, assuming that A is an operator that takes me back to my vector space. So I should be able to write that this is a sum over J's again, EJ. And now I denote my coefficients as AJI. This is my matrix representation for the operator A. And because I am running out of time, let me leave this as an exercise for you to show that if this is the action of A on the basis vectors, then similarly, we can write the action of A on the components of a general vector as A. Ij. Matrix multiplying column vector. I will raise this. Well, besides the last exercise that is left, I did want to say one more thing today that has to do with all this notation. So my question is, can you please raise hands if you have seen the Einstein summation convention before? Okay, in this case, I'm going to say very quickly what it is, and I'm going to ask you to also cooperate with each other if you haven't seen it before, to try to get used to it or come and talk to me, because now I won't have time to go over it very well. So all this thing is that instead of writing things like the sum over J of, let me take one example, whatever, of GI J psi J, to make my life easier, I am going to not write the summation symbol any longer. And this should be, this is psi I. We can use this whenever we have two indices that we are summing over, never when we have more than two. So in general, you should avoid writing more than two indices that are the same in any expression. In this notation, for example, the vector psi can just be written as psi I ei, because the summation here is omitted. The covector can be written I psi I star. And we call those indices dummy indices because they are only there for summation. So I can change them to anything I want. I can write this as psi k e k. The definition of the inverse metric can be written g I k g k j equal to delta I j. Let me just write a couple more examples. The trace of a matrix A with components in that notation Aij. The trace of this matrix, which we usually write as a sum over I, Aii, can simply be written as Aii. That's, for example, when we take when we write delta I, we actually mean the trace of the identity. And if this is an n by n matrix, this will just be n. Come and talk to me during the tutorial if you've never seen this before and you're finding it very strange. But thank you. This is all for today. Sorry for the interruptions.